Hello and welcome to The Music and the Movies, a program that looks at and listens to the sweet spot where music and movies intersect. In this hour, we ponder the special alchemy that happens when sound meets image, where music lovers and cinephiles come together. We explore a different theme in each episode, arranged around an idea or a person, and we delve into why some of our favorite movie moments are also musical ones. My name is Robert Horton. I'm a movie critic and historian and a member of the National Society of Film Critics. I'll play some music and talk about it in an attempt to get to the bottom of a lifelong fascination with why film is so especially intoxicating when music is involved. And at the end of each show, I'll round things off with the trailer, a particular cut that either didn't fit into the overall flow or has some special meaning to me or just so weird it deserves its own spot. So join us, won't you, for The Music and the Movies. Today's episode, Scott Joplin and Company. So here we're going to talk about a composer, not coincidentally, one of my favorite American artists, who never actually wrote music for movies. Scott Joplin died in 1917. That was a decade before sound came into the film business, but whose music has been evocatively used in film. There's one title in particular, which we're going to get to right away, that not only benefited from Joplin's music, but actually brought the composer an astonishing level of renown a half century after his death. And we'll talk about a few more films that are, I think, are very much worth talking about. Our title, Scott Joplin and Company, will also allow us to hear some music that is in Joplin's ragtime spirit, or that just reminds me of Joplin in some way, from some other composers and other movies. And then when we get to the end of the show, I'll use the trailer to squeeze in a kind of a whimsical ragtime tune that you might say leapfrogged its way into popular culture. I don't know exactly what qualifies as musical genius. I lack the musical vocabulary to be specific about that. But as the Supreme Court said when talking about obscenity, I know it when I see it or hear it. And thus I feel confident in ascribing the word genius to Scott Joplin. I have long thought that if Joplin, let's say was born in Salzburg or Vienna in 1750, he would be acclaimed as an unquestioned classical music genius because that's the form his talent would have taken. Instead, he was born in humble circumstances in Texarkana, Texas in 1868. If indeed he was born in that year in that place, there's some confusion on that point, to a father who was a former slave, who had played the violin on the plantation, and a freeborn mother who was also very musical in her life. And also by a great stroke of luck, Joplin was tutored at a young age by a Jewish-German emigre who settled in Texas, a guy named Julius Weiss, who opened a huge range of musical influences for Joplin, but he did not charge for lessons. He must have spotted something in his young black student. Some of these facts I've drawn from a bio called King of Ragtime by Edward Berlin. I read it recently, which, among other things, proved that there are a very great many things that we do not know about Joplin's life, other than, you know, kind of the basic outlines. He spent significant time in Sedalia and St. Louis, Missouri. He ended up in New York City. He was well known as the King of Ragtime after the smash success of the Maple Leaf Rag in 1899, and he died of complications from syphilis in 1917. Even though he did achieve recognition and he was sort of regularly publishing new work all that time, Joplin had really high ambitions, and he was also known to declare on more than one occasion, apparently, that after he'd been dead a few decades, his work would really be appreciated. He was right. Rediscovery came in waves, but triumphantly so in the early 1970s when a couple of recorded albums of Joplin's Rags made the classical music bestseller lists, and this caught the attention of the director George Roy Hill. He'd made Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid a couple years earlier and decided that he wanted that music for his new film, re-teaming Robert Redford and Paul Newman, which was The Sting. The Sting turned into a huge hit. It was the Oscar-winning Best Picture in 1973, and its soundtrack album, made up mostly of Scott Joplin rags, adapted by Marvin Hamlisch, was also a sensation led by the track that we are about to hear, which, and this is just flabbergasting, made the top 10 in the pop music charts that year. From the soundtrack album of The Sting, here is Scott Joplin's The Entertainer. The Entertainer, written by Scott Joplin from the soundtrack album of The Sting. That song, written in 1902, reached the number 3 spot on the Billboard pop chart in May 1974. It was just above Elton John's Benny and the Jets, just below the Jackson 5's Dancing Machine. What a glorious time to be alive. Those were very, very different times. You know, even at the time, people pointed out that The Sting was set in the 1930s, and ragtime had been big 25, 30 years before that, and wasn't that kind of a problem for the film? This has never bothered me. You know, movies today are still using songs from the 60s and 70s for their effects, so why not have ragtime for The Sting? Now, we said that was arranged by Marvin Hamlisch. He won 2 Oscars for adapting the music for The Sting, and as you'll hear in another selection from that soundtrack, his approach did not lack for ideas. The orchestrations here are positively fruity, and I think they really fit the poppy boys adventure tone of the movie. Here's another Scott Joplin song, Easy Winners. from the soundtrack of The Sting, Easy Winners, written by Scott Joplin. Marvin Hamlisch's band works overtime there, but we will hear some solo piano in a moment. By the way, Hamlisch won 3 Oscars on the same night in 1974, 2 for The Sting, for original dramatic score and original song score and or adaptation. They change these categories every once in a while, plus 1 for original song for The Way We Were. Hamlisch conducted the Seattle Symphony Pops program for a few years, and his hosting abilities, hugely knowledgeable, but with the comic timing of a borscht belt comedian, were completely delightful. I hope some of you had a chance to see some of those. Well, the great success of The Sting brought Scott Joplin this long-delayed widespread recognition as a great American composer. He was even awarded a posthumous Pulitzer Prize in 1976. But this was not his first success. When he published the sheet music of The Maple Leaf Rag in 1899, the song made his name, and according to some sources, it became the first instrumental piece to sell 1 million copies of sheet music. The song has been used in many films, though not The Sting, actually, including as early as 1931. It was a tune heard in the background in a club in Public Enemy, a great celebrated James Cagney gangster picture, and that's all the excuse we need to hear the song played here on solo piano by Joshua Rifkin from his 1970 album of Joplin tunes that brought the music to the attention of the Sting filmmakers. That's Maple Leaf Rag, one of the foundational songs of American music, surely, written by Scott Joplin, played by Joshua Rifkin. There's been some debate about whether Rifkin's playing is too slow, but he insisted he was following Joplin's express instructions, which were to treat ragtime as a very precise and measured form. It's not for improvising, not a contest to see who can play the fastest. In any case, ragtime was treated at the time with the usual alarm from keepers of culture. One editorial of the era called ragtime a virulent poison and a malarious epidemic finding its way into the homes and brains of the youth. And another said, these crotchety accents, these deliberate interferences with the natural logic and rhythm, this lengthening of something here and shortening of something there, must all have some influence on the brain. In other words, the same warnings they would make about jazz and rock and roll in future decades. You're listening to The Music and the Movies. I'm Robert Horton, trying to further a malarious epidemic with music by Scott Joplin and company as used in the movies. Let's hear a bit more of the deliberate side of Joplin for a piece used in a really remarkable film from 1978 called Killer of Sheep, written and directed by Charles Burnett, who grew up in Watts, went to UCLA Film School, was part of a vital black independent movement of that era. Killer of Sheep is set in Watts. It's not a work of storytelling, but more of impressions and milieu. It's a beautiful film that has a complex soundtrack of pre-existing music. And actually, because the music was made, the movie was made as a student project, initially shown in, you know, sort of film festivals and that kind of thing, where clearing the music rights is not always such a big issue. And then when it came time for the film to have a proper release, the music rights, and there were songs by Paul Robeson and Earth, Wind, and Fire and you know, a dozen others, were actually a major impediment to the film being seen at all. And it had to wait years to be appreciated. So there's one sequence has wonderful musical counterpoint. A couple of characters are doing this Sisyphus-like job of moving a car engine as Solace, a lilting Scott Joplin melody, plays. Here is a solo piano arrangement from the Sting soundtrack of Solace. That's Solace by Scott Joplin, a song from a scene in Charles Burnett's great film Killer of Sheep. We use the solo piano version by Marvin Hamlisch there. Among the songs that turn up in the soundtrack of the backward-reeling 2008 film The Curious Case of Benjamin Button are some Scott Joplin melodies, among them Bethina. And that's a good enough excuse for us to play this lovely song. It was written in 1905 and was the first song that Joplin published after the death of his wife, Freddie, who died only 10 weeks after they were married. I thought I would play a plaintive adaptation of the piece for violin and piano here with Itzhak Perlman and Andre Previn doing the honors from an album they did of Joplin music. Thank you. That's Scott Joplin's Bethina, a number that turns up during a piano lesson scene in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, but performed here on violin and piano by Itzhak Perlman and Andre Previn. This is The Music in the Movies. I'm Robert Horton, and the title of this episode is Scott Joplin and Company. And in a moment, we're going to look at some other composers of Joplin's era or style, but one more Joplin cut here. The classic documentary Crumb, rather unsettling look at the artist Robert Crumb, includes plenty of vintage songs on its soundtrack, as befits the obsessions of Crumb himself. He's really into that stuff. And one of them is Scott Joplin's A Real Slow Drag. I'm going to talk about the source of that track in a moment. First, let's hear a version, not from the Crumb soundtrack, but given a spirited interpretation by Marcus Roberts. This is A Real Slow Drag. That's A Real Slow Drag by Scott Joplin, performed by Marcus Roberts, a song that began life as part of the score for Joplin's opera Tremonisha. We said earlier that Joplin was ambitious, and he actually completed two operas in his short life. First one failed when it was out on tour, apparently partly because somebody stole the box office receipts one night, and Joplin had to turn over the score itself to creditors. And it was never heard from again. It's presumed to be a lost work. Tremonisha, though, was published in 1911 and has been reappreciated and recorded a number of times in recent decades. It is not primarily made of ragtime music, but that segment, A Real Slow Drag, does conform to ragtime structure. For a bit of controversy about Joplin's life, let's consider that another great American songwriting career overlapped with Joplin in 1911. Young immigrant named Irving Berlin, published a song that would become yet another one of those turning points in American music, just as Maple Leaf Rag earlier had. Alexander's ragtime band turned into a worldwide phenomenon and launched Berlin on the great career that he had. But there was some grumbling from Scott Joplin, who suggested that Berlin had borrowed some musical phrases from Joplin's own work, which Berlin at that time had had early access to, or allegedly he did. There's a lot that's murky about this story, but it was a real thing. In any case, the song was such a standard that almost 30 years later, it had a movie named after it, 1938 film Alexander's Ragtime Band, a star-studded musical with Tyrone Power and Don Ameche. We're going to hear just a little bit of the title number. It's sung by Alice Faye here. And her character is sitting in a public house listening to the band play her song, and she naturally leaps up to belt it out.
My music, a dirty crook. Come on in here. Come on and hear Alexander's ragtime band. Come on and hear, come on and hear. It's the best band in the land. They can play a bugle call like you never heard before. So natural that you wanna go to war. That's just the best band. What else? Oh, my honey lamb, come on along. Come on along, let me take you by the hand. Up you the man, up you the man, who's the leader of the band. And if you care to hear the Swanee River played in ragtime, come on in here, come on in here, Alexander's ragtime band.
Yeah! That's a scene from Alexander's Ragtime Band, with its title song written by Irving Berlin, sung by an actress who was extremely popular during that era, Alice Faye. Well, we were talking about the popularity of the soundtrack LP of The Sting, which I spent many hours listening to as an adolescent. Extremely grateful to that movie for distracting me from nightmarish realities like term papers and homework. And I sort of lump it in my memory with another big-selling soundtrack from a big period film of that era. In the 1974 adaptation of The Great Gatsby, also starring Robert Redford. That one was a great double album, big gatefold sleeve, lots of pictures, featuring music from the 1920s, adapted by Nelson Riddle. And among its gems was a version of a novelty piano tune, maybe just slightly post-ragtime, written in 1921 by Zez Confrey, Kitten on the Keys, which we're going to listen to here in a solo piano version. And I'm not going to tell you who the performer is. Please try to guess it. I will reveal when we return. Thank you. Well, I said that was a solo piano version. Obviously, it was not, as you heard. That's the novelty song Kitten on the Keys, included on the soundtrack of the 1974 film The Great Gatsby, but performed there by Liberace. I mean, it's a novelty song, after all, so why not? And I'm not passing judgment. As someone who's been to the Liberace Museum in Las Vegas, I cannot be a snob here. Zez Confrey, the composer of that tune, also had another standard in the repertoire that turns up in quite a few movie soundtracks, including Thoroughly Modern Millie and the Roger Corman-directed St. Valentine's Day Massacre, both movies from the late 60s. That song is called Stumbling. Let's hear it now in a solo piano version by Noel Lester. A song by Zez Confrey, Stumbling, performed by Noel Lester. I resisted the impulse to play the version by Lawrence Welk, but if you need an accordion hit, you can find that easily enough. Here's another tune that is almost certainly under the influence of Scott Joplin, Dill Pickles, composed in 1906 by Charles L. Johnson, a prolific songwriter out of Kansas City. We included a song here because it turns up on the sizable soundtrack to the 1981 film Reds. Very ambitious project from director star Warren Beatty, a 3-hour biography of the American communist John Reed, along with being a highly unusual period film, complete with documentary-style interviews with real-life observers of that era. The movie has got a great soundtrack of early 20th century music. Dill Pickles is not an obscure tune, was a big hit in its time, and you will likely recognize its jaunty strut. Thank you. That's the 1906 tune, Dill Pickles, composed by Charles L. Johnson, performed by Brian Dykstra. That selection, along with many other period pieces, appears in the soundtrack to Reds, the Oscar-winning 1981 film, something of a dream project for its director, star Warren Beatty. Kind of amusing to think of the meetings Beatty took to get that movie funded. Yes, it's a 3-hour, 15-minute film about an American communist. It's exactly what today's kids are looking for. You're listening to The Music and the Movies. I'm Robert Horton, and this episode is Scott Joplin in and Company. We're going to get back to actual Joplin before we finish here, but I want to pull in a couple of other pieces first. One that I'm suggesting, it's a kind of precursor to Joplin. Wonderfully jumpy piece of music by the New Orleans-born composer Louis Moreau Gottschalk, very popular pianist of the mid-19th century, and whose composing work took on some flavor from the American South and the West Indies. I heard his piano etude Manchega as it plays over the end credits of the 2010 film Aurora. This is a Romanian film by the influential director Cristi Puiu. You've been watching this unpleasant murderer, played by the director himself, actually, for 3 hours of movie time. And when the screen goes black, you hear this, Manchega. And it's as though all the feverish things that were going on inside this opaque man are suddenly let loose by this manic music. Here's that piece as used in the film Aurora, played by Michel Legrand. That frantic piece is Manchega, composed by Louis Moreau Gottschalk, played by Michel Legrand, himself no stranger to film composing. I love that piece, Manchega, and I hear it as a precursor somehow to Scott Joplin's Rags, or at least existing on the same, you know, kind of family tree of American music. Well, I thought it would include a nod to the film Ragtime, which came out the same year as Reds, by the way, though this one was widely perceived to have fallen short of its goals, certainly short of the best-selling novel by E.L. Doctorow. Under Milos Forman's direction, the movie had some interesting elements, for sure, not least the reappearance of James Cagney after 2 decades off the screen, and also a soundtrack composed by Randy Newman. Newman had been known mostly as a highly sardonic singer-songwriter at that point, but he does come from the great dynasty of Hollywood movie composers, the Newman family, and he turned out to be a really good fit for an orchestral style of film scoring. So here are 2 tracks from his score from Ragtime. First, we hear the main title theme, then the kind of oomphier Clef Club One, and you'll hear how he summons up the era of Ragtime. Music by Randy Newman from the soundtrack of Ragtime. An interesting project that didn't really click on screen despite its fine cast and music. Robert Altman was originally going to do that adaptation, and you can imagine that Altman's messy sort of cast of thousands approach might have been a better fit for the novel. That's our trailer music. It means we're near the end, and we get to pop in a little novelty number here. Song that was first heard in 1899. It was a hit then and still recognizable, thanks in part to its prominence in a Warner Brothers cartoon, One Froggy Evening, where it is sung by a cartoon frog. Hello, My Baby was a big hit in vaudeville and written by the Tin Pan Alley team of Joseph E. Howard and Ida Emerson, who were married to each other. In the cartoon, the song lasts only a few seconds, so who better than to carry it off for our purposes than Al Jolson, who has his way with the song here.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime girl. Send me a kiss by wire. Honey, my heart's on fire. If you refuse me, honey, you lose me. Then I'll be left alone. Oh, baby, telephone and tell me I'm your own. Hello. Hello. Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime gal. Send me a kiss by wire. Honey, my heart's on fire. If you refuse me, honey, you lose me. Then I'll be left alone. Oh, baby, telephone and tell me I'm your all.
That's the one and only Al Jolson. Doing Hello My Baby, a song about a man talking to his ragtime gal over the telephone. Well, I've included a few songs that somehow made me think of Scott Joplin and his era as a way of filling out the movie career of Mr. Joplin, who, as we said, died in 1917, a decade before movies talked. Tantalizing to think of what might have happened if Joplin had lived past the age of 48, long enough to at least compete with George Gershwin, perhaps, in the business of combining American pop music with classical ambitions, as Gershwin would do with Rhapsody in Blue in 1924. We'll never know, but we do have Scott Joplin as a great classical American composer, and that is enough. We close with my favorite cut from the Sting soundtrack, Pineapple Rag, which will serve here as a sprightly send-off for the great Scott Joplin. I'm Robert Horton, and I thank you for listening to The Music and the Movies.